or you want to discuss, you defend your standard of living, then yeah, then the free speech will be clamped down upon. That's always been the case, and it remains the case. It's why there isn't real free speech in the West at all.
All right, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Let me thank our guest, Chris Williamson, former British MP and host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified. Do check it out. PressTV.ir is our address for that one. And John Ross, a senior fellow at Chungyang Institute for Financial Studies and former advisor to London Mayor Ken Livingston. Thank you for your input. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Takvay and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Next, you will hear recitation of verse 21. Of chapter Ibrahim from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Reza Yan.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa barazu lillahi jami'an faqala ضعفاء للذين استكبروا إنا كنا لكم تبعا فهل أنتم مغنون عنا من عذاب الله من شيء قالوا سواء علينا أجزعنا أم صبرنا سواء علينا أجزعنا أم صبرنا ما لنا من محيص صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And they shall all come forth before Allah. Then the weak shall say to those who were proud, "Surely we were your followers. Can you therefore avert from us any part of the chastisement of Allah?" They would say, "If Allah had guided us, we too would have guided you. It is the same to us whether we are impatient now or patient. There is no place for us to fly to."
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran warns the European Parliament about the negative repercussions of its push to blacklist the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Israeli forces kill two more Palestinians and injure several others during a pre-dawn raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. And also, U.S. tech giant Microsoft says it will lay off 10,000 employees in response to what it calls macroeconomic conditions. Hello and welcome everybody. The Iranian foreign minister has lashed out at the European Parliament for its plan to blacklist the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps as a terror group. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, in a phone conversation with EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell, dismissed the decision as an injudicious and inappropriate move. He said the draft resolution adopted by the bloc is, quote, sentimental, unprofessional, and harshly worded, and runs counter to political rationality and civility. Borrell, in turn, echoed the Iranian foreign minister's remarks, saying the draft resolution is tainted by sentiments and simply reflects Europe's concerns. He said the resolution is non-binding. Meanwhile, Iranian lawmakers have introduced a motion that will blacklist armed forces of EU countries as terrorist entities if the European Parliament implements its resolution. And Iran has strongly criticized the United Nations' silence on Israeli crimes, saying that it will only encourage the regime to intensify its aggressions against Palestinians. The comment was made by Iran's permanent ambassador to the world body, Amir Saidi Ravani, said the Security Council's current position has emboldened Israel to continue its occupation and savage crimes against the Palestinian people. He added that Israel has been committing criminal acts with impunity for more than 70 years. Iravani said instead of expressing sympathy, the Security Council must take immediate and decisive steps to support Palestinians and hold Israel accountable. Israel ratcheted up its crackdown on Palestinians last year, killing over 220 people in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. The regime's new far-right cabinet led by Benjamin Netanyahu, appears poised to further escalate the crackdown on Palestinians. Israeli forces have killed two more Palestinians in the West Bank as the regime intensifies its deadly crackdown across the occupied territories. 25-year-old Adham Jabarin and 57-year-old Javad Bevagne were fatally shot during pre-dawn raid by the regime's forces on the Jenin refugee camp. According to the Palestinian media, Bevagne, a teacher by profession, was shot in his home by an Israeli sniper. Several other Palestinians were also reportedly injured in the attack. Public mourning has been announced in the city of Jenin. The latest killings bring to 17 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since the start of the year. More than 170 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank alone last year. Mona Candila is joining us now from Ramallah. Mona, it's great to have you with us. First of all, talk to us about this recent Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp and the subsequent fatalities.
Well, almost every day and every night, Israeli forces raid Palestinian cities, refugee camps, and towns in order to conduct arrests among the Palestinians, or this is at least the unjustified excuse given by the Israeli military. The Israeli forces raid the Jenin refugee camp to arrest Palestinians, and the Israeli military claimed that they wanted to arrest Khalid Abu Zeina. He is a senior member of the jihad movement, but they didn't find him at his home. They arrested his two sons during the operation to Jenin refugee camp. Of course, clashes took place between Palestinians, residents of the refugee camp, and the Israeli forces that who usually use their arms during such operations. They opened fire at the protesters and killed two Palestinians, as you have mentioned, 27-year-old Adham Jabarin and 58-year-old Jawad Bawakni. They are both from the Jenin refugee camp. Angry Palestinians took their bodies from the Ibn Sina hospital in Jenin and toured the narrow streets of the refugee camp, chanting anti-Israel slogans and saying that the Israeli crimes would not continue. Palestinians would continue their resistance, whatever the price would be. As you have mentioned, 17 Palestinians is the number of those who had been killed by the Israeli forces. 17 martyrs had been killed. 9 of them were killed by the Israeli forces in the Jenin area alone since the beginning of 2023.
Well, it's also, if you may, talk about the international inaction with regards to this day-to-day violations being carried out by the Israelis.
Nothing more condemnations and slamming from the international community the Palestinians are receiving. The Palestinians don't expect anything from the international community, because it's not the first time when Israeli forces and Israeli regime continue to kill Palestinians. Palestinians had been warning that with the new Israeli regime led by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, there would be even more aggressive policies, more crimes would be committed against the Palestinians, not only expansion of settlements here in the occupied West Bank, annexation of land, confiscation of lands, arrest of people, killing people in cold blood. And the international community is doing nothing but condemning the Israeli crimes, even calling on the Israeli regime to stop such aggressive policies. But on ground, nothing would change. These statements would not be translated into punishments against the Israeli regime. That's why Palestinians feel that the position of the international community is weak and nothing would be done.
All right, thanks a lot. Mona Kandil joining us from Ramallah. Moving on, Russian President Vladimir Putin says victory in the war with Ukraine is, quote, inevitable owing to Russia's powerful military-industrial complex. He added that the complex is ramping up production of military equipment as demand grows because of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine.
In total, our defense industry produces, year on year, about the same amount of air defense missiles for various purposes as all the combined military industrial enterprises of the whole world. Our production is comparable to global production. Therefore, we have something to rely on, and all this cannot but inspire confidence that victory will be ours.
He made the remarks while speaking to workers at a military factory in St. Petersburg. Putin said the unity among Russians and the courage of Russian fighters were other factors making a victory in the war inevitable. In an earlier meeting with Russia's World War II veterans, Putin told them Russia is carrying out a special military operation in Ukraine to defend ethnic Russians and Russian-speaking people there. Moscow says ethnic Russians are subject to systematic discrimination in Ukraine. Kiev rejects Moscow's claim, accusing it of pursuing a colonial-style land-grab policy. Well, Germany has been under mounting pressure from other Western states to supply Ukraine with heavy military equipment. Now Berlin says it will give German-made tanks to Kiev only if the United States agrees to send its own tanks. An unnamed German government source made the comment as Western countries are to meet on Friday to offer more weapons for Ukraine. Poland and Finland have already said they will send Leopard tanks to Ukraine if Germany gives the green light. The U.S. has so far shown no willingness to provide Ukraine with tanks. Unnamed U.S. officials have told media that Washington will only give Kiev armored vehicles for now. Britain is the first Western state that has pledged to provide Ukraine with Challenger 2 tanks. Russia has frequently warned that Western weapon supplies to Ukraine will only escalate the war and increase the suffering of its people. Dissenting views are expressed in the European Parliament regarding EU foreign policy. While some legislators expressed support for Ukraine during a debate in the Parliament, others warned that the bloc's own citizens should not be neglected in the process. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The heads of the main EU institutions defended the 27-nation bloc's foreign policy during a debate in the European Parliament on Wednesday. They insisted that sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro, is the only way to thwart Russia. Most lawmakers agree, but not all.
We see militarization, we see escalation. We are not really seeing a call for peace. We assume it will be the people who suffer the cost of sanctions.
Interest rates continue to rise in the Eurozone and inflation remains extremely high. Sanctions against Moscow and the rapid move away from Russia's energy are the main reasons.
The cost of the living crisis affecting our European citizens unfortunately persists, and we are therefore concerned that the European Council conclusions fail to prioritize the support for our citizens.
Experts warn public support in the EU for the seemingly never-ending cash flow to Ukraine will eventually wane if the war persists, resulting in political consequences.
There can be a kind of danger, which is already looming, that very populistic parties, they can use this as an argument to say, look, this is something we have to cater for our own needs first, and then we have to see what's going to happen in Ukraine.
In an unprecedented departure from diplomacy on Wednesday, the European Council President Charles Michel accused authorities in Iran of operating a, quote, brutal regime. He says more sanctions against Tehran will be announced on Monday. Some lawmakers oppose the policy.
The EU and its partners never stop violating international law, going above multilateral institutions like the UN with their own parallel systems, including punishing millions of people around the world through our authoritarian unilateral sanction regime.
By insisting that rioters in Iran are peaceful protesters and by attempting to directly implicate the Islamic Republic in the Ukraine war, impartial analysts say the EU is being opportunistic, suggesting the new sanctions are trumped up and politically motivated. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
To the UK now, and the wave of industrial action across the country that is only gaining momentum in the wake of the government's controversial new anti-union legislation. Tens of thousands of members of the Royal College of Nursing in England have walked out of their jobs yet again over pay and staff shortages. Said Puduza reports from one of the many picket lines.
From hero to zero, and claps don't pay the bills. Some of the chants by nurses here and across the country on strike again in a dispute with government over not just pay, but patient safety. Emma has been a nurse for more than three decades.
For a long time, we've felt we haven't been able to give the care we want to give because we're so pressed for time, resources,
simply just numbers on the ground. So I think for a long time we've wanted things to change, and it's come to the point where this something has to change, and this is really our only option. Nothing else is working.
The reason behind that, more than 10 years of underfunding and neglect.
Across the country, the health service has been facing what's been described as an intolerable and unbearable strain due to a combination of COVID, the seasonal flu, and staff shortages, with some patients having to wait up to 24 hours for a bed inside a hospital such as this one.
That plus a record 7 million patients on the NHS waiting list, described as a national scandal. The Royal College of Nursing Union demanded a 19% pay rise when they first went on strike last year, but has since cut that in half. Yet a deal is yet to be reached. The Health Secretary, James Cleverly, says the strikes put patients' lives at risk. Last week, the government introduced legislation that, if passed, will enable employers to sue unions and fire employees if they refuse to work on strike days.
Rather than talking about the pay negotiation, talking about safer staffing and the safety and quality of care that we're giving up and down the country in our hospitals, the government have gone down this sort of anti-strike, anti-trade union route. So, once again, so it's interesting to talk about safe staffing levels on a strike day, but what about the other 365 days in the year when we have not enough nurses on duty, not enough doctors, not enough physiotherapists, cancellations of operations and delayed chemotherapy? What about those days? What about safer staffing on a normal NHS day?
The UK has been hit by months of public sector strikes from rail to mail, all of whom say they're in for the long haul. In the weeks ahead, more strikes are planned by nurses, paramedics, and ambulance drivers, with the Royal College of Nursing warning it'll be their biggest walkout yet if pay talks with the government do not progress soon. Saeed Purza, London.
U.S. tech giant Microsoft says it will make large-scale redundancies as an economic downturn is biting the corporation. The company is set to fire 10,000 employees, which accounts for around 5% of its staff. The layoffs begin on Wednesday and will be concluded by the end of March. Microsoft said it has made the decision in response to macroeconomic conditions and fears of a recession. It also said customers' priorities have changed as they are optimizing their digital expenditure. Microsoft has followed in the footsteps of other big technology companies to slash the number of their personnel. Meta, Twitter, and Amazon have already announced thousands of layoffs. That's where Peruvian police have clashed with anti-government protesters in the country's south, leaving one of them dead. The death brings to 43 the number of people killed in clashes between protesters and security forces since the unrest gripped the South American nation in December. Meanwhile, thousands of people have converged on the capital, Lima, to vent their anger at the government of President Dina Boluarte. Peru's General Confederation of Workers has also called for a strike on Thursday. Protesters are demanding the resignation of the president, early elections, and a new constitution. Boluarte assumed office days after former President Pedro Castillo was removed from office and detained over his alleged attempt to dissolve Congress to avoid an impeachment. Castillo's supporters are calling for his release. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Leaders meeting with the people of Qom on the anniversary of the 1978 Qom uprising. On Monday, 9th of January 2023, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with the people of Qom province at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in Tehran. The meeting took place on the anniversary of the historic uprising of January 1978 by the people of Qom against the oppressive Pahlavi regime. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of views expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. Thank you. On Monday, 9th of January 2023, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with the people of Qom. The meeting took place on the anniversary of the historic 9th of January 1978 uprising of the people of Qom against the Pahlavi regime. An uprising which started the non-stop movement of the Iranian people against the Shah's regime. What started the uprising was the publication of an insulting article in the Etalaat newspaper, an article published at the behest of the Shah himself, which insulted the founder of the Islamic Republic, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. The people of Qom, from all backgrounds and from all walks of life, took to the streets and demonstrated against the Shah's regime. Clashes between the repressive security forces of the Pahlavi regime and the people of Qom resulted in some demonstrators being either injured or martyred. The uprising of 9th of January 1978 was quelled, but a bigger uprising, a revolution in fact, was about to start. Soon people in towns and cities throughout the length and breadth of Iran marched and protested against the Shah's regime. And within months, the Pahlavi regime collapsed and the Islamic Revolution had triumphed. Commenting on why it is important to commemorate the Qom uprising, the leader said, "Commemoration of the 19th of day or 9th of January is repeated every year, and that is how it should be. This needs to continue. In the future, this ray of light must continue to shine every year." But why? Because this tragedy was a major transformative event. It was an extraordinary event. It is everyone's duty to keep such transformative historic events alive. Such historic events are either an invaluable experience or they show us a divine tradition. Many examples of this are given in the Holy Quran. Thus, they are worthy of attention and they need to be kept alive. Ayatollah Khamenei added, "Why do we say that the tragedy that took place on the 19th of day, 1978 in Qom, was a transformative historic event? Because it was the beginning of a large jihad. A large countrywide jihad was sparked in Qom. Its aim was to save Iran from being devoured by the West. It was to save Iran from being crushed by the distorted, incorrect Western culture and to free Iran from the political and military dominance of the West. It was to make Iran independent and to revive the country's historic identity. Iran's historic identity is an Islamic identity, an Islamic Iran. From the beginning of the rise of Islam and up until today, which other nation do you know of that has served Islam as much as the Iranians have in various sciences, in philosophy, in jurisprudence, and in other sciences?" The book by Martyr Murtaza Motahari, titled Mutual Services of Islam and Iran, states this quite clearly. Iran's Islamic identity had been lost. If anyone were to walk in the streets of Tehran, and not just in Tehran but in many other Iranian cities too, they wouldn't have felt they were in an Islamic country or that Muslims were living here. That was how they had made it. The jihad that had begun, which was started in Qom, was to save Iran from the state that it was in. The goal was to return Iran to its original, real, historic, proud identity. Of course, those who were involved in that event on that day may not have realized the importance of what they were doing. They felt a sense of duty, which I will talk about, and they took action. Perhaps they didn't notice, or at least not all of them realized what they were going to accomplish. They did not know about the great movement they were creating. They did not realize this, but when we talk about historic issues or events, we must describe them while taking into account the things that happened before and after that event. What caused that event in Qom and what was the outcome of it? This is what shows the importance and value of this event. This tragedy was a truly significant event. It must be kept alive. Its memory should not be erased from history or lose its importance. Of course, the movement of falsehood, the enemies of the Islamic Revolution, always tried to conceal the days of God, Ayyamullah, or to portray them as unimportant. The strategy the enemies use is try to prevent these days from being remembered and from shining in history. Such days are often hidden or denied by the enemies. They even go so far as to deny that these events actually happened. The 22nd of Bahman, or 11th of February, the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the 13th of Aban, or 4th of November, the capture of the Den of Espionage, the US Embassy in Tehran, the 19th of Day, or 9th of January, uprising of the people of Qom, the 9th of Day, or 30th of December, tens of millions of people marching in Iran, 29th of Bahman, or 18th of February, the tragedy in Tabriz, and the funeral processions of Martyr Soleimani and Martyr Hujaji were all examples of days of God. The enemies don't want these days to be remembered at all. Ayatollah Khamenei added, "According to the enemies, each one of these events is like a torch that must be extinguished. The enemies that are against you, against this nation, and against the Islamic Revolution cannot tolerate these tortures. They want to extinguish them. This is exactly the opposite of what is stated in the Holy Quran. The Quran commands us to remember and mention these events. And mention Mary in the book, when she withdrew from her family to an easterly place. What happened for Mary, mother of Jesus, must not be forgotten. This should go down in history. And mention Ibrahim in the book, and mention Moses in the book, and remember our servant Job, as mentioned in the Holy Quran, and remember our servant David, a man of strength, and mention Hud, the brother of Ad, when he warned his people at Ahqaf. Perhaps there are 10 or more examples like this in the Holy Quran about remembering and mentioning these individuals." The leader added, "The Holy Quran says, and in some places where they were concealing matters, God's prophet was assigned the job of getting them to talk. Ask them about the town that was situated on the seaside. Are you concealing what happened on the day of the Sabbath? Ask them about the case when you wanted to deceive God, where you wanted to cheat God, and the Almighty God turned you into monkeys and pigs. You want us to forget this and not know about this. Ask them about the town that was situated on the seaside. This is the logic used by the Holy Quran. The Holy Quran says, if you try to act cunningly and use tricks in dealing with God, then Allah is the best of planners. The Almighty God plans better than you do. Indeed, they, the unbelievers, are devising a stratagem, and I too am devising a plan. Very well, now that you have entered into God's territory, God is the master of the kingdom. This is an experience that took place in the historical life of humankind. As a person living in this period in time, I must understand this. I must learn from what happened to the companions of the Sabbath and what they did. And I should not do what they did again, or I will receive a similar response as mentioned in this divine tradition in the Holy Quran." Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "There are some points about the Qom uprising which teach us lessons. Although the world has moved on and we are living in a very different world today than in 1978, 1979, we need to make use of the experiences of those days. These lessons and experiences never get old, and they're always valuable. The first point is their speed of action. The speed of action of the people of Qom in feeling a sense of duty when they saw what was happening is admirable. They immediately knew what they needed to do. They took to the streets. The shopkeepers came, the businessmen came, the seminary students came, the scholars came. Some scholars from the seminaries came, and ordinary people took to the streets of Qom. They immediately felt they had a duty, and that is the first point. The second point is that they accepted great risks for their actions. They knew and recognized these risks. They accepted them. It is obvious that when you have a regime like the Pahlavi regime, with all their oppression, coming out onto the streets is very dangerous. The people of Qom were very well aware of the dangers, but they accepted them nonetheless. They accepted the dangers and they took action. This is the second point. After all, you cannot accomplish great things without taking risks. The third point is that they took action at the right time. I have mentioned this many times before when addressing various groups. Timely action is what is needed. The Tawwabin sought to take revenge for the murder and martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. They fought and were all killed. All of them were killed, but no one in history has praised them. But why is this? Because it took them too long to take action. If you wanted to sacrifice your life for the cause of Imam Hussein, why didn't you come forward on the first or second day of Muharram in the desert of Karbala so that you could have done something at least? Instead, you stood by and watched. Then after Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, had been martyred, you felt sorry for him and decided to come to the battlefield. This is what happens when you fail to do something at the right time. You need to take timely action, and this is very important. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei added, in 1964, 14 years before the 19th of Day tragedy, and 15 years before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini was exiled from Qom. Why did they send Imam Khomeini into exile? Because Imam had made a keynote speech. What did Imam Khomeini say in his speech? He had spoken against capitulation, which gave legal immunity to the Americans from being prosecuted in Iran's courts of law. He had attacked the United States. What Imam Khomeini stated in that speech, this is the essence of his statement, was that if an Iranian accidentally ran over an American dog in the streets of Iran, he would be prosecuted in the courts of law. But if an American had run over an Iranian, no one has the right to prosecute him. This is what capitulation actually means. So, in effect, by rising up against the Pahlavi regime, the Iranian people had risen up against the United States and its allies. America was the main backer of the Pahlavi regime. And to rise up against the Shah's regime was, in effect, rising up against the United States and its hegemony. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader said, I would like to speak about the recent riots and events in Iran. The involvement of foreign enemies in the recent riots was clearly evident, though some have denied this. As soon as we say foreign enemies, they tend to quickly deny this in order to knock down a faction, or a person, or a group, or an administration. They say, no, it is your fault, but no, it was clear and obvious that the foreigners had a hand in these recent events. The efforts made by the Americans, the Europeans, and the different European countries, each one of them interfered in Iran's internal affairs one way or another. And they interfered openly, not secretly. It was apparent who was involved in this case. That is what happened in these recent riots. We cannot just ignore these things. The most important part of their work was propaganda. The most important part of the enemy's endeavor was their propaganda. I seek protection from the evil of the slinking whisperer, who whispers temptations into the hearts of people, from among the jinn and the people. Temptation don't just come from the jinn. Human beings also whisper temptations. You have seen how it is in the social media, and also the foreign, Western, Arabic and Hebrew media, and other sources like these. So the most important tool that was used here was Western propaganda against Islamic Iran. Some people wanted it to appear this way, and this is how the foreigners made it appear in their propaganda. That in these riots, where a number of people came out, yelled things in the streets, used foul language, broke windows, set trash bins on fire, and things of that sort. They said people were objecting to the weaknesses in management, weaknesses in the economy, and weakness in the way this country is run. But I'm telling you, it was the exact opposite. Those who rioted on the streets of Iranian cities and towns had no intention of overcoming the country's weaknesses. In fact, they sought to destroy Islamic Iran's strengths. They wanted to destroy our strengths and our security. Security is one of the country's main strengths. And there is the matter of scientific education. We always take pride in the scientific progress that we have made in the Islamic Republic. Well, where are the sciences studied? They're studied in educational centers, in universities, in research institutes. The enemies had targeted these centers so they can shut them down, and they can stop the study of science. They don't want us to progress, to make progress in science and technology. The first issue is about jihad of clarification, which I have repeated over and over again, and I will repeat it again. The enemy's main plan is to use false publicity, or propaganda as they call it. The way to overcome propaganda is through clarification. Clarifying the truth must be done by different people, with different voices, with different interpretations, and in new forms. This is clarification. What can remove the temptations that affect the youth or a teenager? Police batons cannot remove them. Clarification can remove these temptations. In final remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, wished everyone present success in carrying out their duties. The leader said, "We have individuals in our universities, in many of our seminaries across the country, and among the different classes in society who are capable of doing innovative, creative, and transformative work. I hope that all of you succeed in all of your duties, and may God bless Islamic Iran."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Patrice Lumumba, the Congo's prime minister.
Part 1.
On August 6, 1945, some eyewitnesses were cited as saying that they had seen another sun rising in Japanese sky. There was no second sun. It was the U.S. first nuclear bomb, codenamed Little Boy, that was exploded at an altitude of 576 meters above the ground over the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, the U.S. second nuclear bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, was dropped on the people of the city of Nagasaki to once again show off America's nuclear capability to the world and its east rival. However, the U.S. Army's show of power in the last days of the Second World War resulted in the killing of 220,000 Japanese civilians. The energy emitted from the explosion of Little Boy was estimated to equal a blast caused by 16,000 tons of TNT. A horrific bomb that the Americans managed to build only because they had got access to large uranium deposits. The country through which the required uranium to build these two bombs was provided lied in the heart of the African continent and was known as the Belgian Congo. June 30th, 1960, the people of the Congo officially celebrated independence from Belgian colonialism. High-ranking officials from the Congo and other African countries attended the official independence ceremony. The event had a special guest. The Belgian king came to the Congo to give the gift of independence to the people of the country. Ceremony, the king hailed the unwavering and wise sacrifices made by Belgium's former king and the founder of the Congo's colonialism, Leopold II, and lauded his efforts to civilize and liberate the people of the Congo from the yoke of colonialism. After the Belgian king's speech, Congolese president Joseph Kasavubu took the podium. But the story did not end there. Although the Prime Minister's speech was not on the agenda, Patrice Lumumba took the podium after President Kasavubu. The participants' stunned look at the Prime Minister had only one meaning. Patrice Lumumba was a dead Prime Minister now. The Congo is so rich in natural resources and vast deposits of mineral that it can be called a treasure island in the heart of Africa. Rivers, dense rainforests, diverse animal species, and unique underground resources, including copper, gold, uranium, coltan, and diamond, and in most cases, there is no other known example in our world to rival them. Despite its huge natural wealth, the Congo is among the world's poorest nations. This contradiction is rooted in successive calamities aimed at looting the Congo's natural treasures throughout history, which were endured by the people of this country. The crisis broke out when a white European decided to civilize the people of the Congo. In the late 19th century, Belgian King Leopold II sought to keep up with European neighbors. He had to find a colony to remain in the race. Most of the world's regions that were rich in resources had been already seized by competitors at the time. Africa was the only viable option. Sponsored by Sir Henry Morton Stanley, one of his friends, Leopold tried to find a suitable land as his colony. As an explorer in the heart of Africa, Stanley traveled along the Congo River and purchased land for the Belgian king after negotiating with African tribal chiefs. He bought the lands at a very low price, for example, in exchange for some clothes. So, in the early 1880s, Leopold could turn a land spanning as much as 900,000 square miles, that is 87 times the size of Belgium, into personal property. In 1884, the U.S. became the first country to recognize Leopold's sovereignty over the Congo. Leopold took advantage of this opportunity and officially claimed Belgium's sovereignty over the Congo. The shadows of Belgium's colonialism continued to affect the people of the Congo 8 years later and even after Leopold's death. The Congo's indigenous people were exploited as slaves in the country's mines, where they extracted their country's natural resources for the Belgians. The indigenous workers' wives and children were taken hostage to be subjected to harassment and even sexual abuse if the indigenous man refused to work, and they were sometimes murdered. At that time, one of the most common punishments for disobedience was to cut off the two hands. Although the Belgian government made extensive efforts to conceal its crimes in the Congo and even destroyed certain documents and reports, the articles that were published years later by Western journalists about that era revealed that as many as half of the Congo's population had been killed during Leopold's 40-year rule, which amounts to a massacre of tens of millions of people. The days of independence dawned after years of fighting by the people of the Congo. During the battle, the voice that was more vociferous than those of others belonged to a good-looking, determined young man named Patrice Lumumba. He wanted to obliterate the legacy of Leopold, which continued to haunt his country. Lumumba was imprisoned for his anti-colonialism activities for a while, but he was elected as leader of the Congolese National Movement in 1958. A movement led by the young Lumumba, which managed to overcome ethnic and tribal differences and revive the spirit of national unity and independence seeking among millions of the Congolese people. Heading a delegation, Lumumba went to Brussels and took part in Congolese independence talks. The negotiations resulted in holding the first free elections in the country. The result of the election stunned many, including Belgian colonialists. The MNC party won the election and Patrice Lumumba became the prime minister. Lumumba's government took office on June the 24th, 1960. He invited all people, even white Belgians, to unity to build a Congo. However, his Independence Day speech worried all those who had a vested interest in the Congo. The Prime Minister did not have to deal with the Belgians only because other powers like the UK and the US had gotten involved in the Congo as well. Lumumba's remaining in power as prime minister could pose a big challenge to those countries' growing interests. In August, the CIA station in the Congo sent a telegram to Washington that stated, quote, "Embassy and station believe the Congo experiencing classic communist effort to take over government," unquote. The message was addressed to CIA Director Alan Dulles, who had already managed to overthrow popular governments, including the one led by Mossadegh in Iran and Arbenz government in Guatemala. Dulles warned the U.S. government against catastrophic consequences of communists' encroachment in the Congo, which could likely pose a threat to the free world's interests. On August 18, 1960, President Eisenhower told Dulles that the U.S. needed to do everything it could to remove Lumumba from power. Dulles sent a cable to Lawrence Devlin, the CIA's Congo station chief, ordering him to take more aggressive yet clandestine measures to that goal. The first coup plot in the Congo was hatched with the help of the U.S. Western allies. The state of Katanga was a rich mining region in the Congo, which had large deposits of copper, cobalt, uranium, and gold. Moise Tshombe, an old friend of Western multinational corporations, was the president of the state. Katanga proclaimed its independence and secession from the Congo only 11 days after the country's independence and staged rebellion against the central government and Prime Minister Lumumba himself. It is worth mentioning that as much as Moise Tshombe was pro-Western, he had a strange grudge against Lumumba.
These first films taken from behind Katanga lines show Katangese soldiers fighting through the streets.
As the first step, Belgium immediately backed Katanga's independence proclamation. The situation was worsening, and Patrice Lumumba needed extra help to deal with Katanga's separatist forces. Lumumba knew well that his Western enemies accuse him of supporting the Eastern Bloc. However, he did not ask for the Soviets' help, although they were famous for supporting anti-West reformist movements. He instead sought the U.S. help. But under the pretext of avoiding a conflict with the Soviets, the U.S. ambassador proposed that the Congo should ask for help from the U.N. Therefore, upon a request from Lumumba's government, U.N. blue helmets arrived in Leopoldville and were deployed to some regions, including Katanga. But these forces failed to carry out an effective measure to counter Katanga's separatists. To get more help to counter rebel forces as well as Belgium's military interventions, the Prime Minister headed to the White House without an official invitation. Against all his expectations, the U.S. did not welcome him. Certain American newspapers called him the dictator of the forest, and American officials refused to provide any sort of assistance to the Congo's democratically elected Prime Minister to resolve the country's problems. Fifteen years later, the U.S. Senate launched extensive investigations into interference of the CIA and the U.S. government in the Congo. The probe was led by Senator Frank Church. According to the reports of the Church Committee, the then U.S. president had issued a direct order to the CIA to assassinate Lumumba, and the CIA had launched a plot to eliminate the Congo's prime minister. To achieve this goal, two projects were put on the agenda. One of the projects was proposed by Joseph Schneider, a CIA scientific assistant. According to Schneider's project, a lethal virus indigenous to the Congo had to be administered to Lumumba in any possible way. In the second project, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb injected a lethal poison into toothpaste that was sent for Lumumba in a diplomatic package. But memoirs of the CIA station in the Congo said American spies in the Congo failed to carry out the operation. As the toothpaste passed its expiration date and was in fact useless, the evidence of crime was dumped in the Congo River. After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Lumumba's government needed air transport to dispatch its forces to the state of Katanga. The Soviets provided the Congo government with their aircraft to transfer forces. Relative peace was restored to Katanga. However, the Soviets' assistance provided the best excuse for the U.S. to launch more covert propaganda against Lumumba.
At his news conference, President Eisenhower faces squarely the Congo crisis, which he feels is aggravated by the Soviet Union's intervention by sending planes, technicians, and arms.
The United States deplores the unilateral action of the Soviet Union in supplying air.